We're going to get started here. This is the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. It's Thursday, January 15th. We don't yet have a quorum, but we're going to get started, and then when we do, we'll officially call the meeting to order. Today, we are going to have kind of a criminal law overview, and that will be provided by Danelle Kendall from the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. So please come to the table and state your name for the record and go ahead. And members, feel free to interrupt to ask questions. Just make sure you get my attention and I'll call on you. So go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Danelle Kendall. I am Spence County Attorney and President of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Good afternoon, and thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come and give what's been basically described to me as Criminal Justice 101 to a group of people who will have a significant effect on criminal justice in Minnesota in the coming year. Just a little background on me. I've been a prosecutor for 20 years. I prosecuted in Hennepin County early in my career. I was Mille Lacs County Attorney for 3.5 years, and I have now been Spence County Attorney since 2002. I've tried anything from speeding tickets to homicides, but I do specialize in sex crimes and domestics. So in terms of getting deep in the weeds on the details of what prosecutors do, that is my area of expertise. I recognize that on your committee, you have one of my former colleagues, Dave Olin, the former Pennington County Attorney. Representative Coolidge Jackson and I work together in the courts in Mille Lacs, and we have in my office answered questions for Representatives Mullery, Less, and Tamar a number of times in the past. I also know that we have a police chief, a paralegal, someone in corrections. We have a high school teacher in my hometown of Blooming Prairie, a gentleman here from Owatonna. I recognize you from your picture on the website, sir. Plenty of lawyers and also someone who knows it matters that I am a 10-year 4-H-er. Where's the extension agent? All right. Okay. So, that's who I am, and I've done a little homework on who you are so that I can best not bore those of you who know about the criminal justice system, but at the same time try to address the issues of those of you where this would be new. So I'll do my best to do that that balancing act. I've also brought along...
I'm going to interrupt you for just one second. We officially have a quorum, so I will formally call this meeting to order. Go ahead.
Thank you. I brought along... This is the Criminal Justice Bible in the state of Minnesota. This is West's criminal law handbook, and you'll notice I brought the 2008 version because that one's already all marked up so I can get quickly where I need to go if you have questions. These are the statutes that you pass that we live by. These are also the court rules through which those have to be interpreted. This is the sentencing guidelines. These are all of the details that go along with that. So if you work in the criminal and we're going to touch a little bit on the juvenile justice system in Minnesota, here's what you need to know. And you will see this carried by most people in my line of work. All right. Prosecutors' work begins with the cops. We don't take complaints from private citizens. We take our business after the cops have responded to a call because there needs to be an investigation first. And commonly, my office receives calls expecting that we will represent someone in a criminal case, either a victim or a defendant, and that is not our role. We represent the state. And please, from the beginning, please understand that criminal charges are brought by the state. It's not accurate when they say on TV that the victim chose to press charges or drop charges. The state of Minnesota, on behalf of its citizens, brings charges. Cops do investigations. The victims are witnesses. But ultimately, that charging decision does rest in the state of Minnesota with the prosecutor. So when that initial call comes, it may come from the victim, but it might not. It might come from a neighbor. It might come from a parent. It might come from a mandated reporter. And it doesn't always come immediately after something happens. There might be a delay because the victim didn't know something was wrong. There might be a delay because they were embarrassed about what happened. Very commonly, in sex crimes and domestics, we have delayed reports. Same thing in employee theft, for example. Not everything comes in like you see it on TV, where someone immediately knows that a crime has been committed and calls for law enforcement assistance. So when law enforcement responds, and you do have the more typical examples of coming home and finding your house burglarized, for example, or if you were held up at gunpoint, obviously that would come in immediately. Either way, law enforcement responds and they investigate the situation. They talk to the victim. They find the witnesses. Hopefully there will be witnesses. Hopefully the victim will be cooperating and willing to talk to us. There might be search warrants involved. That might be when the Minnesota equivalent of CSI, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, comes in. Now, if that call comes in within a town or a city, that goes to the city police department. If it's in the rural area of the county, it goes to the sheriff. There are also statewide organizations that might come in by invitation. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, for example, has investigators that can come in at the invitation of the local law enforcement officials. The State Patrol has a separate role. The DNR has a separate role. But law enforcement's job overall is to investigate if what happened is a crime. And if so, what happened? When did it happen? Where? Who? How? All those classic questions. Now, you'll notice, though, that why is not one of the classic questions that law enforcement is immediately investigating. The police chief among you, I don't know which one that is, or if he is here.
Not in the room yet.
All right. He can tell you, you know, the why is less relevant at the beginning. Sometimes people are drunk, sometimes people are stupid, and sometimes people are just plain evil. The immediate sense is to figure out what happened here and if it was a crime, because it only comes to the prosecutor's office if it ends up being a crime at all. Why comes into place in sentencing, not in determining whether or not it is a crime. So first we decide, is it a crime? Getting to why may affect more what we decide to do about it versus whether or not it's a crime at all. And that actually is a topic of law that may come before you in the next year that I want to talk about a little later. So when law enforcement is doing their investigation, lots and lots of rules to follow. You might see those on TV as technicalities. Somebody got off on a technicality. Well, those technicalities are based on laws that you write or the constitutions of the state of Minnesota or of the United States. You should be aware that the Minnesota Constitution has been interpreted differently than the United States Constitution on 10 separate occasions in the state of Minnesota, and those have all fallen in favor of a defendant's rights. The identical words might be viewed differently by our Supreme Court, and we need to know that, and we need to follow those rules that are set out by our Supreme Court based on our constitutional rules as they set them up. Now, it's prosecutor's job, again by statute that you wrote, to train the cops on what those laws are. So we need to know not only what the United States Supreme Court allows, but what the Minnesota Supreme Court allows, and what your statutes say the rules are in Minnesota. All of this matters so that we can use the evidence in court, because all the investigation in the world, all the witness statements, all the victim reports, all the cooperation doesn't matter if the way that the cops then collect the information violates the statutes that you write or the Constitution, and we can't use it in court. So we do spend a lot of time doing that training. We spend a lot of time with the cops. We value them greatly. And usually on a public safety criminal justice issue, if they are before you asking for something, we'll be right there beside them. We spend a lot of time together, and it is, in fact, our job, per your direction, to train them in what the rules are. So not surprisingly, you'll see us side by side often. So basically, law enforcement does the investigation. They determine that they believe a crime has been committed. When they send something up to the prosecutor, they need a standard of probable cause. It's more likely than not that a crime happened and this person committed it. So prosecutors, we'd like you to take a look at this and decide if criminal charges will be filed. Now please understand that more likely than not is not the standard the prosecutor is then dealing with. Before we put a complaint into the criminal justice system, we have to be able to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Much different, more likely than not, probable cause than beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where not every investigation that is submitted to a prosecutor ends up being put into the criminal justice system as a crime because of that difference in standards. Two levels of crime in the state of Minnesota. Misdemeanor. Most you're going to do is spend 3 months in jail, pay a $1,000 fine. Most low-level first-time crimes, misdemeanors. Second level is a gross misdemeanor. Might spend up to a year in jail, $2,000 fine. Usually, that's misdemeanors that have been committed multiple times or misdemeanors that have been committed with some sort of aggravating factor. For example, a DWI with a child in the car makes it a gross misdemeanor rather than a misdemeanor. The things you're going to hear most about and that most people hear most about are felonies. These are the ones where you could potentially end up in prison. Now again, jurisdictionally, city attorneys handle mostly misdemeanor crimes. All of the felonies come to the county attorneys, the independently elected official in each of the counties in the state of Minnesota. We handle all of those, and we handle all juveniles. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. The Attorney General in the state of Minnesota has very limited direct authority to charge a crime. Where you will usually hear about the Attorney General in criminal cases is if a smaller county has asked the Attorney General to step in and provide assistance because they simply don't have the resources to handle some of the bigger crimes that happen in the smaller jurisdictions. So where the Attorney General becomes very important to especially the smaller counties, generally outside the metro, is coming in and handling a big case that happens. They also do many of the criminal appeals for the smaller counties, and they also do sex offender commitments for the smaller counties. So very relevant on those type of things, but they only come in and do that if they are asked by the elected county attorney to do that. So you've got your cop investigation. It goes to the prosecutor. We have our separate set of things that we look at, and here's what we look at when it comes in. Do I have a crime here that I can prove beyond a reasonable doubt? Have the cops followed the rules in doing their investigation so that the evidence that they have collected is actually admissible in a Minnesota court? And to put a crime into the system, it's not only the fact that eventually I may be standing in front of a jury to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, but I also have an ethical obligation to not sign a complaint, put that on somebody's name for the rest of their life, and haul them into a system that I know I can't complete the process on. Very high ethical standards, in fact, separate ethical standards that only apply to prosecutors and which we are held to very highly in the state of Minnesota. So sometimes when you see that, how come that didn't get charged? How come it got charged in that way? There's not only the proof beyond a reasonable doubt issue, but above and beyond that, can't you just try? Can't you just put it in there? No. If we know that we can't meet those rules and can't meet those burdens, we can't and we shouldn't. Now that means on the occasion that we do file a crime, we're extremely serious about it. If we file a felony, I have to be able to stand in front of a jury of 12 people and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt to all 12, not 9 or 10 or 11, all 12. If one of them does not feel that every element of the crime has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant walks. Now, the jury only decides guilty or not guilty. They do not decide sentencing, so I want to talk separately about sentencing. But ultimately, please understand that if a prosecutor files a criminal charge, that is very serious business, and we only do it if we believe that we can prove it at the end of the process. Now, if we have a defendant in custody at the time that that is happening, that the cops send us the investigation and we have to make that critical decision on charging, if he or she is sitting in jail, we have 48 hours. From the time the cuffs go on, we have 48 hours to make that decision. That's where you see the cops going around the clock, literally 24/7, on major events, because whether that is a misdemeanor assault or whether that is a homicide, the same 48-hour rule applies. So we have a lot of information to collect and assess and decide what we're going to do about this in a very short time period. We usually, in a major crime, do not have all the information that we're going to have eventually. So that is also why we need to have a strong relationship with our law enforcement so that we have a reasonable idea of what they're going to be able to collect that they haven't so far, that they know the rules, that they followed the rules, and that we're going to be able to carry this out. Because obviously in major investigations, everyone is watching, and the decisions that get made in a very short time period must be accurate. On the flip side, in most cases, the defendant is not in custody when we're making those decisions. So we have a longer amount of time to look at what we have, and sometimes we will ask for follow-up investigation before we actually make that charging decision. Generally then, again, the charging decision is made by the prosecutor, and county attorneys are directly elected by the people and are directly responsible for not only following all these rules, but looking at what our communities would want done with these type of things. Applying some judgment, applying some discretion. Is criminal charging really the way to go about handling this matter, even if you could have proven a crime beyond a reasonable doubt? Is that the right thing to do in this situation? So the complicated factors that you're going in these short time frames are significant. Now, once we make the decision to file the complaint and put it into the system, the defendant pretty much takes control of the prosecution from there on out. They control the timing. If they want a speedy hearing, we have a speedy hearing. If they want a speedy trial, we have a speedy trial. I have nothing to say about that. That's up to them. As soon as we go into the criminal justice system, we have to hand over to the defendant absolutely everything we have. The good news, the bad news, all of it. They give us nothing, we give them everything. That's okay, because the only person going to jail or prison at the end of the day is the defendant. So fair and right that the system should be set up that we have to give them everything that we have. Here's what I got on you, no secrets, want you to know. And likewise, if there is something in there that is exculpatory and tends to make them look less guilty, we have to give them that too. That's the way the system works. We hand it all over, and the burden is purely on the prosecutor to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. The defendant does not have to prove that he or she is not guilty. I have to prove that they are. At each stage of the proceeding, as you go through the court process, they can challenge all those rules we talked about at the beginning. They challenge the constitutionality of the investigation, with the statements taken appropriately, and it would be a whole separate session for us to go through what all those rules are, what someone might challenge, and why. But that is totally up to the defendant once the prosecutor puts the complaint in the system. The judge up till now, all he or she has had to do with it up to now is signing the complaint, because we put the complaint in the system, but a district court judge does need to agree that there is at least probable cause to proceed. And if there are challenges to the admissibility of the evidence, the judge is basically calling balls and strikes at that point based on their knowledge of court's interpretation of the statutes, what it was that you meant when you wrote the statute, and interpreting all of those type of things to make sure that everyone's rights are getting protected.
If I could interrupt here for just a moment. If you could actually maybe get into the difference between the juvenile system and the adult system now, I think that might
So far, no difference.
Okay.
Really, the biggest difference between the juvenile system and the adult system is when you get to sentencing. Because the rules are applied exactly the same way in the law enforcement investigation as well as in the decision to prosecute.
Okay.
So far, it's identical. But we're now starting to talk about settlement and sentencing, and you'll catch kind of some of the differences. The main one being, if you're an adult, you're already 18, the presumption is that you know what you're doing, you've made some conscious decisions, or you've made some really poor decisions, and we're trying to make that not happen again. For juveniles, we're talking about rehabilitation. It's less about punishment and deterrence and restitution and decision-making than it is recognizing that these are kids, recognizing that this may not be as much intent as it is ignorance, and trying to really, truly get to the root of what's going on and fix it so that by the time you're 18, you don't end up with a real live long-term impact.
Great. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Office of Settlement. Let's talk about how we go about settling cases. Not surprisingly, can I prove it yes or no? And I shouldn't have put it in the system if I didn't believe at the moment that complaint was signed that I couldn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So I'm looking at the strength of the case and the ability to prove that, but also at that point, all right, what do we have here? Was this severe? Have you done this before? Is this same thing different day for you? Is this an isolated incident? What kind of restitution do you owe the victim? What kind of harm has been done? Do you need a fine? Do you need community service? Do you need treatment or counseling? There is treatment and counseling required in some crimes that this legislature has passed, in domestics and DWIs specifically. Probation, jail time, prison. All right, prison, this is jail. I'm surprised at the amount of misperceptions there are on which are which. Jail is local. Go over there, do your jail time. If you have a job, we'd like to let you out on work release because we'd like you to keep your job because you have restitution and fines to pay. It also just doesn't work well for rehabilitation if you take away the good things that a defendant has going for him or her. So if you put you in local jail, very often there may be some punishment part of that, but it's more about kind of paying your debt, keeping the good news, and moving on. We use that for people that we're mad at. We say prison, Big House, Oak Park Heights, Stillwater, for people we're afraid of. There's a difference in who we're mad at and who we think we can work with and who we are afraid of. We send actually, and I think you've heard from the corrections folks earlier this week, we send very few people to prison in Minnesota. Last information I have is we're second lowest in the United States of America in our incarceration rate. You have to do something really bad right out of the chute, or do smaller things many, many, many times to go in prison in Minnesota. It's just how it is, because that's when we get to the point that we're afraid of you. And the only thing that we can do to protect society from you is to take you out of the mix. fair enough. That is the decision that the legislature has made about how we're going to go about incarcerating people. How sentencing really works when we determine which is which is based on the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. What the legislature has also decided is that there will be maximum penalties for each crime, but that you would delegate to the Minnesota sentencing guidelines. And I have handed out, and I imagine corrections handed out as well, the grid that they have developed in determining how that's going to work. Okay? And you'll see that we have a separate grid for sex crimes because of the different dynamics involved in those as for other crimes in the state of Minnesota.
We're going to interrupt directly on this. Representative Bingham had a question a little earlier. So, Representative Bingham.
I can ask it now. thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question, I guess, about is there ever circumstances in this system where, you know, you have the prosecutor and defense attorney,
mm-hmm.
where the state is, meaning the county attorney's office, required to pay for any sort of expert witnesses on private defense attorneys? Does that ever come up?
There are specific statutes that I can't say to you off the top of my head that talk about who pays for what in that sense. Certainly in public defender clients, we have to pay for things. If there are things that are required by law, there may be circumstances in which counties are required to pay as well, but honestly, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head, but I can get you that information.
Thank you. Representative West.
And thank you, Ms. Kendall. Along those lines, if there's a dispute about a matter that was decided by a judge for trial, and it's appealed by the defense, which sides pay for that?
Ms. Kendall, go ahead.
If it is in a general sense, the state public defender is paying for the defense part of the appeal and the county is paying for the prosecution side. Often the AG steps in and helps us with that. Where the county ends up getting jammed with both sides is in a pretrial appeal. And I believe that's what you're referencing. Where one of those decisions early on to decide what evidence is going to be used at trial, if the prosecutor truly feels that the judge was incorrect in his or her assessment and decides to appeal it before we get to trial, because we can't appeal it after trial. If we don't have the evidence at trial, we're done here. So we have to deal with it ahead. Right now the law says that the state pays for both sides of that, both the defense and the prosecution side of the appeal. And what's happened in recent years is the public defender's office has changed some of the way that they're going about doing business. Is they're finding those out to private counsel, and we're getting thousands and thousands of dollars in defense legal fees on our pretrial appeals. And that's whether we win or lose. We pay either way.
Okay.
Representative Black.
Sure, if I can, and I would have, if we were in committee, I would have objected to that being a narrative. No, just kidding. But yes, you didn't anticipate my next question, and members, this is a fundamental fairness issue, whereby if the state ends up having to pay the entirety of the cost in these pretrial appeals, when in fact the state appeals versus just one side or the other. And you may recall that we dealt with that in previous sessions, but it didn't go all the way through, so it will be coming back up. But thank you for your answer, Ms. Kendall.
Thank you, sir.
Further questions? Okay, Representative Beth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kendall, I'm wondering in light of the governor's prioritization of public safety, if cuts in CPA to counties and counties responding by their own budget cuts could affect the number of assistant county attorneys in some counties and the county attorney's offices in their ability to do their job as part of, you know, public safety.
Absolutely. Each county is going to have to figure out how they're going to deal with the cuts. And some counties have said public safety is outside that consideration. Others have not. Already we're seeing hiring freezes. Already that's in place in many counties around the state. Already we are seeing salary freezes of the people that are already there, so people may make different choices based on that. We're going to see differences in exactly what's available in our budget for training. We're going to see, you know, the expert witnesses that we hire, how is that going to look? So absolutely we're going to see it in the county attorney's offices. Where you'll also see it is in the sheriff's departments. One of the things that I expect you'll hear quite a bit about this year are short-term offenders. One of the things you'll hear about is using interactive television to change the way that we handle some of these criminal justice hearings so that we don't have to haul people all over the state to get it done for a two-minute hearing. Absolutely, we're going to see changes.
All right. Please continue.
Thank you. Let's step ahead then, since you've already heard about the sentencing guidelines, and please ask if you have further questions about who goes to prison and who doesn't. But I'm going to assume that you've already heard a bit about that this week and ask you to jump in with questions if you have them. I want to talk a little bit about plea agreements, because plea agreements have kind of a bad reputation out there, and quite frankly, let me just give you a reason that they are 99% of the criminal justice system. A plea agreement is an agreement by the prosecutor and the defense attorney and the defendant that the defendant did something wrong. Not only is an agreement by the defendant that he or she did something wrong, but we're going to agree on exactly what they did wrong and exactly what we should do to make sure it doesn't happen again. That is a very valuable process when you're dealing with the criminal justice system that is supposed to be addressing bad criminal behavior. If the defendant is willing to step up to the plate and say, you know what, yeah, I did do something wrong, and here's exactly what I did, and making me prove it is not going to make my situation any better or worse, I'm going to take responsibility for this, but I'd like to have some certainty, which most human beings like, to know what's going to happen to me if I do that. It's called a plea agreement. That means everybody agrees on what happened. Now, the statutory maximum sentences get addressed in plea agreements? The absolute maximum that you've allowed us to sentence people? No, not usually. Because between the guideline system that you've already heard about and someone's willingness to take responsibility for their wrongdoing, we are able to come to an agreement as to what should happen. Those agreements are usually not only the defendant accepting responsibility, but making restitution to the victim. There's a deterrent value to everyone else who might be sitting in the jail or the community seeing what's going to happen if this happens. There's restitution getting paid, there's fines getting paid, and there's certainty that there will be incarceration, and there's even certainty as to how long. So the common question of how do you get to a plea agreement comes way back to the beginning. What does the investigation give me? Can I prove a crime? Can I prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? What should happen? And if the defendant understands their situation and chooses to take responsibility for it, that's called a plea agreement. So it's not a bad, awful thing, at least from the prosecutor's perspective.
What percentage of cases would you say you do in plea agreements?
We handled roughly 3,500 criminal cases last year. We had 41 trials. Everybody else pled guilty. There may have been a couple dismissals in there somewhere along the way when a case came apart, so I can't say everybody pled guilty, but out of 3,500 trying 41 juries, and I think that's pretty typical. Different counties have different cultures. When Representative Cruz Jackson and I were in Mille Lacs, I was a little more likely to have trials over there because the community reaction was different. Defendants had a lot better winning shot with a Mille Lacs County jury in some types of cases than might be in some different county. St. Louis County tries a lot of trials. They very much believe in putting it to the taxpayers to see what they should do. Some counties have almost no trials because their resources are such that the judges really try to get the parties to work together to resolve cases. So it's a little bit different county to county. Who the elected county attorney matters, what the defense bar is like matters, what the judges are like matters, because they're all human beings and they all have their own attitude. But they're also, for the most part, elected officials responding to the people who put them in office. So that probably has the most to say about how that really plays out.
Thank you.
Now, if you can't say that we have a trial, one of the things you will probably hear about this year is whether or not the trial should be to a judge or a jury. The way the laws are written right now, the defendant gets to make that choice. If the defendant says, I want to have a trial to the court and not to the jury, that is solely up to the defendant. Prosecutors want to talk to you about giving us something to say about that, and today is not my day to advocate. It's just to let you know that that might be an issue that comes before you. Now, if we have a trial and we have an acquittal, we're done here. That's why we have to have, as Representative Russ pointed out, pretrial appeals, because we have to know what evidence we have going into trial. We don't get a second bite at the apple. If there's an acquittal, there's an acquittal. Now, if there's a trial and a conviction, then we are in a little bit different sentencing situation. If we have a trial and a conviction because we didn't have a plea agreement, because there was not responsibility taken, the judge now has one of the few in my county, 41 times that we had a trial, and not all of those were convictions in the last year. The judge has one of the few times that we have a wide open sentencing argument. And he or she is no longer looking at a defendant who said, you know what, I want to take responsibility for this and I want to do what I can do to make it right. So it's a little bit different analysis as you're looking at that person and deciding what to do. One of the other things that you will likely hear about this year is some changes in constitutional law and in the statutes as to when we can really unload on someone, when we can use the statutory max. I can tell you that in prosecuting for 20 years, four times have I got it or came anywhere close to it. That's it. In the cases that I've tried, it is very seldom that you go all the way to the statutory max, partly because of the guidelines and partly because, thankfully, truly horrendous things that really deserve it don't happen that often. But when they do, there has been some United States Supreme Court case law in 2004 called Blakely versus Washington. They have a sentencing guideline system much like ours, and the United States Supreme Court took issue with exceeding it. They said, you know, the guidelines say it should be this long, so if you're going to go way over here, we need to have some different procedures in place to do that. So that is one of the things that you will likely be hearing about this year as to how we would go about reaching the options that you had given us. Now, within the last few years, you have significantly changed what I call nuclear sentencing. We've had a case in St. Cloud within the last year and a half, a stranger rape, where he abducted her, he beat her up, he sexually assaulted her, he robbed her, he kidnapped her, he left her for dead. You gave me a nuclear sentencing option that allowed me to argue to the judge that consecutive sentences for each of the things that happened to that girl were appropriate. The judge granted that request, and right now it's in front of the appellate courts to see how they will interpret your laws that you gave us, because they've hardly ever been used, because we hardly ever get in a situation to do that. And that defendant actually pled guilty without a plea agreement, straight up, knowing full well that that's the argument that I was going to make. So we're all watching to see how those new nuclear options that you gave us are really going to play out in the appellate courts. So we've got one out of Stearns County that's sitting there right there, or sitting there right now, and you very well may hear some more about that. Because obviously, if there's a big enough dispute to have a trial, there's probably a big enough dispute to have an appeal. And certainly we have seen more and more appeals in the last few years. Now part of that, right now we have a court system that's willing to listen to arguments that have failed repeatedly in the past. And sometimes they will even go so far as to rule on issues that the parties have not brought up. So we're going to see a lot of appellate activity when that's the reality of the situation, and we go in and continue to make our arguments right next to the public defenders, and sometimes the court changes the rules. Which brings us all the way back to the beginning, to our statutory obligation to go explain to the cops, the courts just changed the rules, and now we need to do it a different way.
We're going to, you're actually only going to have about 5 more minutes.
Okay.
So we've got a lot of ground to cover, so I want to make certain that you maybe prioritize what the...
I'm actually almost done.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Fair enough. Okay, very briefly. Juvenile system, as we already talked about, that's about rehabilitation, that's about fixing these kids before they get into the adult system. How do you get into the adult system as a kid? You do something really bad when you're 14 or older. Biggest factor is what did you do? Second factor is what's your history been before, but with kids, we do ask why. We ask, what were you thinking? If you did something really bad and what you were thinking was also really bad, you're in the adult system just like that and you're going to prison just like an adult. But if the reason that you did it and what your history is tells us that we might be able to work with you, you're not. We have one of the coolest creations in the United States called an extended jurisdiction juvenile in this state. Thank you, legislature, for giving us that option, and please let it stay, because I've heard it's expensive, I've heard people approach you to get rid of it. This is one of the pieces of advocacy I'm going to do today. What that allows you to do is take a kid who should be in prison and give him or her a chance until they're 21 with a prison sentence hanging over their head. I treat them as a juvenile and an adult at the same time, and they get to pick how it comes out. very valuable. That's the one crossover between the systems. Let me just give you a quick rundown of some things that I think you'll be hearing about this year. We already talked about Blakely versus Washington and the sentencing guidelines versus going nuclear on somebody and giving them the statutory max that you've authorized. We'll probably hear about that. Crawford versus Washington was the United States Supreme Court again getting into it with the state of Washington on the ability to actually make a witness come into court and testify. There used to be a way that in a domestic case or in a child sex case, for example, if the victim was unable or unwilling to face the group of 12 strangers and say what had happened, that there were ways that we could get that testimony in front of the jury. The United States Supreme Court said not anymore. That has significantly affected the criminal justice system in those areas, and it is possible that you will see something on that. Drug sentencing, 152 is coming back to you, talking about drug kingpins, talking about the reality of modern marijuana, talking about real options for what's going on there with drug cases, and how we can get you some reality checks on that. Interactive TV, very important, going to save lots of money if we can make this work. The reason we haven't used interactive TV for long distances is it makes the public defenders crazy to not be able to be there with their client, with the judge, all in one place. Fair enough. Let's figure out technologically how we can make this work for everybody. If we can find a way to keep the defense bar happy, this will save amazing amounts of money for counties, for sheriff's departments, for the public defenders, for the prosecutors, for everybody. Mental illness defense, if any of you were around and that came through the last time, that was a knockdown, drag-out fight. It will be again. Minnesota is one of the states that doesn't allow experts to come in and tell our juries what to think. Okay, sorry that was advocacy, but obviously prosecutors and defense attorneys will very much disagree on that, as we have in the past. Could come up. No proof of insurance is the most popular ticket in traffic in the state of Minnesota. If you get pulled over and you don't have proof of insurance, you have to show up and prove to the judge in district court that you have it. Gosh, that seems like a waste of time. We'd like to bring you a presentation that shows how that can go back to where you renew your tabs. You can go show the people at the Department of Motor Vehicles that you have proof, because 80% of them do, and it's really wasting a lot of judicial time. Is there a way to an attorney in a self-protection case, and if so, who pays for it? That's coming to you. You may hear about the standards for terminating parental rights and taking kids away from their parents forever. We've had some recent court decisions that have changed the rules on that, changed the rules that you wrote. We may need to come back and talk to you about that. And finally, you may hear about diversion. You have required all county attorneys' offices, but not all city attorneys' offices, to have diversion programs. But you leave it totally up to the independently elected official which of those first-time offenders should not go into court versus do. You've left that prosecutorial discretion alone, but I can tell you that the rules from county to county are dramatically different, depending on the community, depending on the prosecutor, depending on the resources that are available, and there's at least some talk of making that the same, which would basically decriminalize a number of offenses. So, very sticky topic. We are the frontline prosecutors in the state of Minnesota. We very much appreciate having the opportunity to make this presentation, and we are available to you for the horribly difficult session that you're supposed to have, to provide what insight we can on what cuts are made and how they're going to affect the criminal justice system. That's our job. We've been working a lot more with the Public Defender's Office, the State Public Defender, through Chief Justice Eric Magnuson's Criminal Justice Forum. We have 8 things ready to bring to you that prosecutors, defense attorneys, prisons, probation agents, the criminal justice system all agrees to save you some time and money. And we're pretty excited about being able to bring those topics to you. We're here for you. It's going to be a long year.
Questions from members? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is the public defenders. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kevin Cuyer. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. And I apologize in advance for my voice, but I've been battling a cold, as some of you know from this week, and we just had our monthly board meeting because we've been doing a lot of talking this morning already. With me also is John Stewart, he's the State Public Defender. Madam Chair, in your packet there should have been a handout, hopefully you have it, entitled the Board of Public Defense Health Public Safety Committee. And for those of you who don't know, some of you have been around for a while and others of you are new, so we'll try not to bore the old folks with some of the basic things, but cover as much as we can. The federal and state constitutions both provide that anyone charged with an offense punishable by loss of liberty, in other words, going to prison or to jail, is entitled to representation by a lawyer. Minnesota statutes also provide that there are other folks who are entitled to representation, and we'll talk a little bit about that further down the line in terms of who those folks are. In Minnesota, that responsibility falls to the Board of Public Defense. The Board is a judicial branch agency whose sole purpose is to provide quality criminal defense services to indigent defendants in the state of Minnesota. The Board consists of 7 members. We have 3 members appointed by the governor, 4 members who are lawyers appointed by the Supreme Court. And the Board's duties, if you will, they appoint the state public defender, they appoint the district chief public defender, they distribute the appropriations that come from you all, and set standards and policies for the operation of the public defender system. To help them accomplish this, the board a number of years ago had a strategic planning session and put together a list of goals that they would like to see each of the district public defender offices accomplish. Those 5 goals are on page 5, a client-centered representation, creative advocacy, continual training for all staff, recruitment and retention of excellent staff, and a partnership in the justice system. When we talk about a partnership in the justice system, we're not only talking about our relationships with the prosecutors and with the court, but also with all of you in terms of changes to criminal justice or criminal laws. As County Attorney Kendall indicated, we're part of the Chief Justice's Task Force in terms of looking at some of those efficiencies and some of those other issues. We're also part of, as some of you know, the Coalition to Preserve the Judiciary in terms of the funding piece, as are the county attorneys. And I realize we're not in the budget process here, and it's not the budget committee, but on page 6, we have listed a group of priorities in terms of budget and service. In 2003 and 2005, faced with some very difficult budget decisions, the board developed a list of budget principles and service priorities, and you could take a look at those. And those will again come into play a little later as we talk about some of the other issues that we're facing. Obviously, the top one for us is prioritizing service to clients in custody, evaluating the staffing of special reports, elimination of non-mandatory cases, and again, that will be one we'll talk about in a little bit. The organization is, we have 3 programs. We have our district public defense, we have our appellate office, we have our administrative services office. We provide services, the board is there to provide services, mandated services on the trial level and the appellate level. And that's basically what we do. As you know, as some of you have heard, there are 10 judicial districts in the state. We have 10 judicial district public defender offices around the state, roughly 375 full-time equivalent attorneys. About half of those folks are part-time. And I would just like to spend a little bit of time talking about part-time defenders, because as you get outside of the metropolitan area, particularly out Hennepin and Ramsey, the part-time defenders are really kind of the backbone of the public defender system. As I indicated, they are a majority of the defenders in greater Minnesota. They are all state employees. They are classified in basically 3 groups. They are 75%, 50%, or 25%. They are paid on a biweekly, what we call a lump sum basis. So they are paid 75, 50% or 25% of what a full-time defender were to make with similar experience. For that, they agree to take whatever cases are assigned to them. And so as cases go up, as the time commitments go up, these folks are really gambling on whether or not they're going to be able to provide that service, keep a private practice running, and make ends meet. They cover their own office overhead, so they pay for their own office, their own secretary. We do provide them a modest stipend for overhead, ranging from $1,200 if you're 25% time, up to $3,600 if you're three-quarter time. And those of you who are in private practice know that's a long way from what the actual overhead costs of running an office are. On the district level, and I want to get back a little bit to part-timers in a minute, but on the district level, we provide constitutionally mandated services in felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, juvenile delinquency cases, and by statute for children over 10 in child protection cases. So that's the statutory requirement that I referenced earlier. In the past, we've handled about 175,000 cases a year. We are on track this year at about 165,000. So you can see on page 11 that the kind of distribution of those. What we do as we distribute money, or I should say as the board distributes funding, and as we look at it, we look at weighted cases. So we look at how many misdemeanors a district has, how many felonies a district has, how many juvenile cases a district has, and there's a case weighting that goes into place there. On page 12, you see the chart of how that plays out in terms of the actual workload, and you can see that the workload is actually about evenly divided in terms of the weighted case standards between the at least the four major groups of cases, the felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and juvenile services. So as we talked about, and I know some of you have talked about, you know, what do we do with misdemeanors, and what do we do if we have to cut services back? Well, the misdemeanors are obviously the majority of the cases we do. In terms of the actual work, in terms of the actual time commitment, it is a much smaller amount than that. Excuse me. Public defenders, by and large, for serious cases, represent anywhere between 80 and 90% of all serious crime cases that come through the public defender system. That is a fairly standard percentage across the country. Either through a public defender system or appointed counsel. The board standard and ABA standards are roughly about 400 units, case units per year. When we talk about a case unit, it's roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. So as I indicated, we have part-time defenders out in greater Minnesota. They handle a mix of cases. Most of the time in the metro area, folks are handling a mix of cases. 400 is the standard, and again, is a fairly consistent standard across the country. Our folks right now are right around 745, 746 case units. That tends to be a little misleading, and I want to back up a step or so, is that A, it doesn't count the time commitments, and we're going to talk a little bit about time commitments. In terms of not only the part-time defenders, but the full-time defenders. And I want to give you a couple of examples of that. There also is some reason to believe that we have some under-reporting by our public defenders. And if you can imagine in your business, and frankly being here in the legislature, when you're putting in the kinds of hours and the number of cases that these folks handle, the top priority for you probably isn't to fill out your case reporting and your time reporting form. It just that's the way it is, particularly for part-time defenders. They either have to do it or they have to have their private secretary be doing that work. In terms of the time commitments, what that number really doesn't represent is, and I'll give you a couple of examples. We just did a real quick and dirty analysis of our Chief of the Falls office. And we have an office in Thief River Falls, frankly, because we can't find part-time defenders to do the work up in that area of the state. And they cover all the way to the Canadian border. They cover Roseau, they cover Willow, they cover Red Lake Falls, and Rippers and Orleans, and probably tell me other counties that they cover off the top of his head. But their folks spend about 10% of their time on the road. And if you've ever been up in that area, you can imagine some of the distances that they have to cover. A couple of other examples. We have two part-time defenders in International Falls, Minnesota. We did. As of December 30th, one of them retired. We don't have the ability to hire another part-time defender in International Falls, so we have to run somebody from Grand Rapids to International Falls. The court in our falls has been very accommodating in order to cutting back the schedule there. But Grand Rapids to I Falls is 80 or 85 miles one way. So we're paying mileage, we're paying somebody to be on the road for a couple of hours, but they're not in the courtroom, or they're not, you know, in the office doing that work. In Mankato, our Mankato office serves three different counties. Again, the travel distance is really starting to wear on those folks, and it's another issue of not only paying for them to be moving or traveling, but also the time away from the office. On page 14, I mentioned sometimes the issue of the part-time defenders.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just before we hop off of page 13, how many of the, do you know what the number of case units, I guess is what we're referring to here, the 746, how many of those are non-mandated cases versus the mandated cases? Can you give us that?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, those are all mandated cases. And we'll talk a little bit about the non-mandated ones because it is based on fiscal year 2009. It is a projection, but it is pretty consistent with past history. So, as I mentioned, Madam Chair, part-time defenders, and if you look on page 14, last fiscal year, they put in about 84,000 hours that they were not paid for. That is roughly the equivalent of 24 full-time equivalents. So when I say that 736 number is a bit misleading, it is a bit misleading because those folks are putting in an awful lot of time and effort that they're not being paid for. And it is a matter of putting an awful lot of stress on a system. We have, as you all have probably heard, almost the identical demographic that the state workforce does. We have about 30% of our attorney staff is over age, well, now over age 52. So we have a huge number of those, but about 70% of those are part-time. And so as those folks retire, as I mentioned, the gentleman in International Falls, as those folks retire, we're having more and more difficulty trying to find part-time defenders to do that work, particularly in greater Minnesota.
Representative Olin.
Madam Chair, and clarification on some of these part-timers. Are you running into a situation by chance where more part-timers are getting out right now?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but more of them are getting out?
At this time?
Mr. Tyer.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Olin, yes we are. It is really, for example, up in your area, and I use it as an example because we've had historically troubled areas. We have one public defender in the northern third of the 9th Judicial District. That's the fellow in International Falls. And you might say there's not a lot of cases there, but as Representative Olin can tell you, there are cases up there. And there is court there, and that has to be covered. And as County Attorney Kendall indicated, there are time constraints that have to be met for both the prosecution and for the defense. It has become an issue for us is physically that we just cannot be in all of those places. And I want to give you two very quick examples. One is in the 10th Judicial District. Since July 1st, we have had 25 different personnel changes. And when I say personnel changes, they are 25 different reassignments within the counties of the 10th Judicial District, just so we're able to cover a different calendar. So somebody might have been practicing in Wright County, they're now going to be in Anoka. Somebody who's in Washington may now have to be, Chicago. Those kinds of things. In the third district, we had a situation, and I don't bring this up as a comment about the judiciary, but I bring it up mainly as an issue of caseloads, is our chief public defender down there was in trouble with one of the courts, was going to be held in contempt because she was not appearing for a probation violation case in one particular county, when at the same time, 25 miles away, she was trying a court trial on a gross misdemeanor case. So she had to be in two different places at one time. That is a routine occurrence for public defenders. In the metro area, in Hennepin and Ramsey, you know, they're down the hall. It's a little different situation. I mean, it's still not good, obviously. If you go down to the difference between this was a particular case of Oratana to Rafika, if I remember correctly, is you're talking about 20 or 25 miles. That routinely happens. Victims sit, prosecutors sit, court people sit, and you can just imagine what happens with those. The chair asked that we talk a little bit about applying for a public defender and the eligibility. On page 15 is the information on the applying. Applications are reviewed by the court. Minnesota Statute 611.17 governs eligibility. Basically, if the defendant or any defendant in the household receives means-tested benefits, that person is deemed eligible for a public defender. Secondly, as you can read on the bottom of page 15, is if there's a combination of liquid assets or current income, or someone that would be unable to reasonably pay the reasonable cost of an attorney, private attorney, they also could become eligible. I have been doing this for a long time. I sat behind that desk as a staff person for quite a long time before that. This issue has come up every year. It comes up across the country. And the argument really becomes down to, I think, a philosophical one that you all have to make, frankly, and the court ends up making, is it a matter of truly somebody being indigent, or is it the issue of somebody truly not being able to afford private counsel? We have a former board member who was in private practice for a long time. Felony case up in Anoka County is $10,000 down payment up front. A DWI, $3,000 to $3,500 cash up front, because they know if they lose, and again, County Attorney Kendall mentioned that, you know, 99% of the cases get food argued out. Somebody's going to either be doing some time or going to be having some other issue. Those defense lawyers know they're not going to get paid, so they want it up front. And my own experience recently is with a civil issue. I was charged $175 an hour, and I think that was a break, frankly, because I happen to know the lawyer and the lawyer's dad. So it's a very expensive proposition to hire a lawyer, particularly if it's a complicated case and you're talking about a felony or a gross misdemeanor case.
I want to interrupt you real quick, Representative Lex.
Thank you. Mr. Kyer, I was going to wait until you were done on this, but, you know, if it is expensive, if I get a DWI tonight, and I don't plan on it, but if I do, yeah, if I want a good lawyer, I mean, they're probably going to charge me $4,000 or $5,000 up front. I don't have $4,000 or $5,000, but if I'm sitting in jail with the prospect of sitting in for a couple days, I'm going to, like probably a lot of people at this committee table, we're going to find a way to come up with $5,000. Now, there are a lot of people that are in no position whatsoever to find a way to come up with $5,000. However, as you say, your office represents 80 to 90% of the statewide serious criminal caseload. And last I recall, it was 70% of every single case, if that's still correct, I don't know. That's a pretty huge weight on a huge impact on what private attorneys are able to charge. If you can go in and potentially someone who's really hungry is going to say, yeah, I'll do it for $1,500. But if there's an immediate and very real option every single time for a public defender, we don't check up on it, that's going to impact those initial prices. Do you agree or not?
Madam Chair and members, I don't know. I really don't. I know that, yes, there is a certain amount of, how shall I say it, a comfort, if you will, with the judiciary, that public defenders are in the courtroom, they're there every day, and as you know, they're highly skilled, highly qualified folks that are able to move the cases along. And there is, I guess, potentially there is an incentive there to appoint public defenders to keep those cases moving. And when you talk about 2 million cases a year going through the justice system, or, you know, there is that, or potentially that bias.
Okay.
Representative Less.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had another question. And I'm going to follow up with a couple questions if I can, Madam Chair, just because I've already asked one.
Representative Less, you do want them to have the opportunity to, so maybe just ask one or two now and then
I'll
them
just
finish
wait for
their
the
presentation.
Just put my name on the list.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, you know, I just started my second term, so not like I've been here like Les has. But,
I fill a seat.
Have you ever been asked to be part of overall discussion about improvements to eligibility, about oversight, thoroughness, of review of the application?
Mr. Kaya.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. Representative, Madam Chair, and Representative Bingham, yes, the court system had a task force about eligibility about 15 years ago, and I was on it along with the court administrator from Lake County and a couple of the Supreme Court staff. And we recommended changes in the standards to tighten up eligibility, and we wrote a model application form to be used in all 87 counties and distributed that to all the judges. The previous standard before our group went to work was whether the judge thought it would be a substantial hardship for the person to hire a private lawyer. And of course, that was wide open to any amount of discretion, because it would be a substantial hardship for any of us in this room to hire a private lawyer for a major case. So we wrote the more specific standards that are in there now, and we did design a statewide application and distributed it.
Thank you. All right, please continue.
Madam Chair, as I indicated, for those of you that are following along, I'm on page 16, but we are the largest user of the court system. We provide services in every county, every courtroom. We're really the kind of the quality control of the justice system. And the caseloads and the time commitments, as you've heard from the court, I know, is controlled really by outside factors. We don't choose, pick and choose the cases that come to us. With the State Supreme Court case, the Subiot v. Mott, which indicates that public defenders once assigned cannot refuse cases. Those outside factors that we talk about, prosecution patterns, police, legislative changes that you all make, if you look on page 18, there's an example of some of those outside factors that we're talking about. Again, I'm not here to say you shouldn't have done them or anybody shouldn't be doing them. I'm just here to tell you that we are a system, and what ends up happening here or what ends up happening in Stearns County or wherever also impacts public defense. And you can see some of those. Between 1987 and 2005, the legislature created 86 sentencing enhancements, 26 new judgeships. Again, there are 26 new calendars, 26 new courtrooms that have to be covered. Does the judiciary need those judgeships? Absolutely. But it comes with a price to the public defender system. The Hennepin County Sheriff awarded a $500,000 grant for reducing cold hit cases and DNA. It's a wonderful opportunity. But I believe, if I remember the story right, is they have a a lab technician or two, and one or two additional prosecutors that are now going to literally bring those hundreds, if not thousands, of cases into court, and now we have to somehow be able to respond. Again, I'm not here to say they shouldn't have them. I'm just telling you that those are the kinds of things that impact not only the court, but defense. Sting operation. We had one in Roseau County last year, 2 years ago, where we had 35 co-defendants that came out of Roseau. Again, it was a great operation, and the county attorney can prosecute all 35 of those. For us, if there are conflicts, we have to have separate lawyers for all of those cases. And I don't know if we ended up with, I think we ended up with 22 lawyers or something, but we brought lawyers all the way from Duluth to handle some of those cases. So again, not saying it shouldn't be done, but those are the kinds of push and pull that we end up getting in the system.
Well, I'm going to let you know that you have like 8 minutes
okay.
to finish because we want to have time for Representative West's questions
okay.
to other members.
Madam Chair, two other issues that we'll bring up is you had asked us to bring forward the issue of the child protection cases.
The
changes that we have made. As the state took over the public defender system back in the late 80s and early 90s, one of the issues that was kind of left on the table, and there was very little discussion about it, is the representation of parents in child protection cases. Those kids who are over 10 years of age, we represent. Kids under 10 get a guardian ad litem. But there was really not a lot of discussion about the parents' issue. And at the time, there were about 3,800 of those cases. Under Minnesota Statutes 260C.331, this is a county responsibility to represent those parents. We are, again, mandated to represent the children over 10. By 2006, we went to about 9,000 child protection cases or appointments. At the same time, the court implemented what they called the Children's Justice Initiative, which put all sorts of programs in place, if you will, or best practices in place for handling these cases. Again, one of those issues where nobody's arguing that it isn't a good idea, but it just increased the workload of these cases tremendously. And for everybody, not just for public defenders, but also for the prosecution. In some instances, we were appointed to represent non-custodial parents, so we would have literally multiple clients in a lot of these cases, particularly in greater Minnesota, again, where you have to bring lawyers in. This spring, when we faced a roughly $3.8 million deficit for this year, we again went back to our priorities, which we had established, that the board had established in 2003, and said, what are we doing that is not mandated? The representation of parents in child protection cases was not mandated. The representation of clients in post-adjudication drug courts was not mandated. Both of the things that we left by the wayside. We lost 12% of our attorney staff this spring, about 100,000 hours of attorney time. There was just no way we would be able to handle all of those cases. And so that was the decision that was made. The last thing, Madam Chair, and I know I'm running out of time, is in our appellate office. The appellate office, again, provides constitutionally mandated services in criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, supervised release proceedings, or what we commonly think of as parole revocation hearings, and then the sex offender community notification and review hearings. The last couple of pages there show you some of the increases that have happened in that appellate office. I don't have to tell you all that the prison population has exploded over the last several years. That's the population that the appellate office deals with. So obviously, as the number of folks committed to prison goes up, the number of appeals goes up, the number of post-conviction remedies go up, and there's just no real secret about that. And they've experienced some double-digit growth over the years. I know that was quick, Madam Chair, but that's kind of the overview of the board and what it is we do.
Questions from members? Go ahead. Representative Dirkhouse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. How do you say it?
It's Kyer.
Kyer, thank you. I'm not sure you're
starting.
Yeah, you're Kevin. Mr. Kyer, could we get a copy of the application that was used? I think that would be helpful for or at least for me anyway. Thanks.
You could provide that to the committee. We'll make sure that.
Madam Chair, we can provide you, I think, if we still have a copy of it, the original application. I will tell you that every county or judicial district is kind of using their own application. So because there is no requirement that the counties or the judicial districts actually use the application, if I remember correctly. And John, you may have more.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, it's in the rules of criminal procedure in the appendix of forms, so it'd be pretty, you could get it in 5 minutes if you want it.
We can get it. We'll get to something. We'll send it to staff and they can get it out.
Thank you. Representative Bingham. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just out of curiosity, I just noticed the wording of the statute that says for eligibility, a minor 10 years of age or older who represents kids under the age of 10 if they need protection in the six cases. Or, Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Bingham, they get a guardian ad litem because at that age it's thought that they ought to have somebody who's looking out for their best interests rather than to have a lawyer.
Alright. Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Kyer. I'm wondering, based upon your, what I saw was essentially a nod that you're about 70% of the entirety of the statewide criminal caseload, can you assure this committee that all those people you've represented are indigent?
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, as I mentioned, the issue is really one of a philosophical one. Are they indigent versus can you afford an attorney? And I will tell you that varies by judicial district, it varies by county, it varies by judge. That's not, you know, I mean, you got 300 people making, essentially making the decision. I don't think it's all that different from the 201 legislators who have their individual ideas about, you know, what should happen. So,
Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Kyer, if I understand it, your response is that you do represent people who, if they're not indigent, they can't legitimately afford an attorney as well, right?
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Representative Lush, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. If I may, before I ask my next question, I pulled up your mission statement here online. The State of Minnesota Board of Public Defense, our mission to provide excellent criminal and juvenile legal defense services to indigent clients through an independent, responsible, and efficient public defender system. I think maybe you should take another look at your mission statement, Mr. Kyer, Mr. Stewart. But with that, I would ask, do you think either Mr. Stewart or Mr. Kyer, you play any role in ensuring that the people you represent do qualify, or if it's a philosophical difference, genuinely cannot afford an attorney? Should you guys, your attorneys, or anyone else play a role in that?
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I think we do play a role in it. In addition to the work of tightening up the eligibility criteria, I brought the leading test case in eligibility because I believed somebody had been appointed a public defender in a murder case who was concealing assets, and that's the... But the case actually is called In Re Stewart now because it was, the case ended up with my name on it. The actual offender was a guy named Schleicher, not me. But Mr. Schleicher hid $100,000 worth of real estate, and we caught him and took it to the Supreme Court. And that's how come you get the language that says that the court has to take a close look at the person's assets, including transfers, including real estate, and so on. We have several cases that come up every year where I'll have a chief public defender call and talk with us about making a motion to withdraw from representation of somebody based on the fact that they really have some assets and we really believe that they could afford to pay for counsel. Because to me, I consider it to be like stealing from the food shelf. If a person really has the money that they could be hiring a lawyer and they take a service away that was meant for poor people. So, to the best of our ability, we do watchdog that, and we bring up cases every year in the trial courts, and at least once we've taken it up to the Supreme Court.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stewart, thank you for your answer on that, too, because I know that if I was in trouble, I know that the first lawyers I'd be looking at for help would be the public defenders I work with. I get plenty of privates who walk into the courtroom who don't know which way is up, and it can be frustrating when I see their clients paying good money for that. So, and I appreciate you doing that. I have seen a few public defenders actually do that as well, and the first time I saw it was when I think it was Nikki Kubista down in Ramsey County saw that her client did in fact have a substantial number of assets. This is my first year practicing, and requested that restitution be made, and that's when I discovered that it was capped out at that time at $40 an hour, which was, I thought, a little ridiculous considering what Mr. Kyer brought up before, that in fact he would have had to pay at least $2,000 or $3,000 up front to get representation, let alone quality representation, which is what he was getting from Ms. Kubista. Would your office oppose any kind of legislative action which would mandate restitution if assets were discovered during the course of the representation?
Representative Less, I'm actually going to hold off on that question because I've asked the folks that came before us not to advocate on behalf of a position. And so if maybe you guys could work that out and then introduce some legislation, we'll have a hearing and talk about it. But I would prefer that you not put them on the spot right now and ask them for a position, because I wouldn't let them advocate on behalf of the things they wanted to advocate on behalf of today either.
Okay.
All right.
Let's see what questions that cuts out of my
Representative list. Bingham has a question, so I'm going to go to her while you think about that. So, Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this second is the most appropriate time, but at some point I think it would be helpful, maybe if Representative Less is introducing a bill, to maybe go over the process if there is a request by the prosecutor, like a motion that they do believe that there is assets there that are being hidden. I think at some point, Madam Chair, it would be helpful to have some testimony on that, the procedure of which that occurs, whether it's brought up by the public defender or by a prosecutor.
Representative Bingham, the procedure's fine. That's not advocating a position. So if you'd like to talk about that,
Madam Chair, and members, and I think Mr. Stewart wants to comment, we will be bringing a bill forward, and hopefully that will at least put a bit more consistent application across the state in terms of eligibility, maybe putting a dollar figure into the statute rather than the means tested, and the chair may be bringing that forward to you. In terms of the restitution hearing, the question then's going to become is that another burden on the public defender to represent somebody in the restitution phase of that, or some other lawyer? And so now, and I don't know that. I mean, that's something obviously we all have to kind of sit down and talk about, because if we're going to end up doing that for a relatively small amount of money, are we going to be, is that going to make any sense? I will mention very quickly, Madam Chair, is there is a reimbursement statute right now where public defenders who represent folks where the court determines there are some assets or there is some ability to pay, they can be ordered to reimburse the public defender system for those costs. We don't get that money. That money goes to our part-time public defenders to help offset their overhead. And it's done by judicial districts. So the money raised in a judicial district stays in that district. So there is some of that goes on right now.
Representative Anderson has a question, and then Representative West has got 2 minutes, so I'll come back to you, but we do need to approve the minutes before we leave. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Geyer, Mr. Stewart, the governor in his State of the State address mentioned that public safety was the number two item that he wants to keep safe as far as monies, and yet you just mentioned that you wanted to see some more consistency come about, and then in the body of his statement, the governor also mentioned that he wants to see the counties come together and utilize their funding much better, however I want to say it, in a way that he'd come down to a regional type situation where these counties would go into almost like the 10 judicial districts that we have. But I'm thinking that he's also talking about the counties and the county court system going to the regional system. And do you have anything that you can recommend from a public defender standpoint to help you and sure. Help me more consistent and coming up with better ways of doing your system right now?
Let me, Madam Chair, and Representative Lynch, a couple of things. One is, out in western Minnesota, out in Wilma, they do what they call a tri-county arraignment system, where they have three counties that have come together to do what you're talking about in terms of those services. I don't know that it's happening anywhere else right now, but that's certainly something that's been very helpful for all of us, because we know how many, there's a certain volume of cases that can be handled there. We know folks, you know, how many folks have to be there every time, and that works out very well out there. Whether or not that can be replicated, I don't know. Secondly is that we are on the task force that the Chief Justice mentioned yesterday, and that County Attorney Kendall mentioned, is we are looking at all of those things. Because it is a system. It is, and we're all part of it. But I did not hear the governor's remarks today, so I can't really comment specifically on his remarks. So.
All right. Final question, Representative Lesh, and be aware that we are over our time and the next committee's in line.
Okay. And I may have missed this in your comments earlier, either Mr. Stewart or Mr. Kyer, but based on the recent discussion of the Supreme Court's decision to make certain things payable or mandatory appearances, which statutorily would be eligible for jail time, no longer being eligible, do you now consider those people to no longer be in play for application of public defenders because the courts have decided that they're going to be payables now? And if you answered that, that's fine, but I didn't hear the answer.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, the court has got a lot of different proposals in the air right now. Yesterday, the Chief Justice said they might stop processing misdemeanors, period. So, the payable thing would sort of depend on what the consequences are to the person if they don't pay the payable. If it's going to be simply that the case won't be recorded as a crime and the person will be added to the civil judgment roll, I think we would stay out of the picture. On the other hand, if the person doesn't pay and they're going to go arrest them and put them in jail and revert it to a misdemeanor, that would probably bring us back into the picture. There are a lot of questions about the mass administration of payables that haven't been worked out yet.
All right. And with that, members, our next meeting is Tuesday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. It's a joint hearing with Representative Paymar's Public Safety Finance Committee. And with that, we are adjourned.